You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, this is Chris Corby, and you're listening to Rebel Radio.
Man, fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. My guest today is Chris Corby. He's the CEO and founder of Stage Pilot, which is creating virtual and in-person fan experiences for artists, working with clients from Kehlani and Lil Yachty to Korn, Metallica, so many others. They're doing really incredible stuff, and we talk about some of the cool things they have coming up. We also dig into Chris's background as a designer and how he brought that kind of design thinking and the DIY ethos of his punk rock history into this world of technology. He's got some great lessons. I was not expecting to hear his great perspective on hiring and leadership and team building and you know how he's pivoted through some pretty major challenges that he's faced in building this business, as well as how he works with clients to create a vision and bring that to life, and some really big insights that I think we can probably all benefit from. So I hope you'll enjoy this one. Let's get into it with Chris Corby.
Nice. Well, I'm excited to dig into what you're doing, and your journey seems really interesting. So let's get into it.
Perfect.
Let's go back to the very beginning. Do you remember the first record you bought for yourself?
Oh yeah, Thompson Twins. I don't remember the name. Yeah, it's not like that's not one that you look back on super fondly, but I was aiming for like a virgin. It was sold out. Ended up with a Thompson Twins cassette.
That's funny. I mean, Thompson Twins had some hits. You know, Hold Me Now.
Oh yeah.
What was that song, Lies? Like they had some good records. You know, I don't know what happened to them. I guess it didn't stick with it or whatever. But that's so funny that you say, because you know that thing of like going to the store and then once you went for it, sold out, so you end up with something else.
Yeah, exactly. You went. They had 15 cassettes. I mean, I grew up in a relatively small town, so it wasn't like limitless albums, and you'd show up, try to get in line early, and you got what you got. But
crazy.
That was so amazing that at that point I was picking albums. Like I had my first two choices and then I was straight album art. Like whatever album art looked good, I would give that record a shot. And that was
absolutely.
It was hit or miss.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And so you got, sounds like you were down the art lane pretty early. Did you grow up, you know, drawing and designing, or how'd that happen?
Yeah, I grew up about an hour north of Boston, which now is like a bedroom community. But at that point, it might as well have been, you know, a day away. It was kind of the middle of nowhere. I was pretty deep into skateboarding and then really deep into local hardcore from like middle school on.
Oh, okay.
And it was just, we had one kind of little country store that had a decent magazine rack. And so, you know, I became that kid that knew the delivery guy and just waited for the new Thrasher, Transworld, or Freestyling or whatever. And
yeah,
But there's no access to anything, right? Like if you wanted, if you know, you could buy the three decks that they had in the local store. Right. If you wanted anything right. else, you needed to like wait till you ground it down and draw your own graphics on it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was constantly doodling and drawing and kind of trying to make my own clothes, my own stuff, look my own way. Yeah.
Nice. So did that, that DIY ethos, right? From, you know, grinding down your own decks and to obviously the hardcore scene, that's all DIY, right? You know, how much of that do you carry with you today?
I think it, there was like a big ebb and a flow for me. I mean, that was kind of everything to me through high school. And then I got to college and studied art and business in college. And it never occurred to me you could make a career out of that. I mean, I had friends that made kind of cut and paste show posters and that kind of stuff for their own zines or whatever, but it just didn't occur to me there was a career there.
Right.
I did kind of happen into graphic design. Actually, I found an animation studio at our school and a friend let me in, and I was just, this was like seven old machines in a dark room, and you couldn't get in, but the graphic design program was led right across the hall. So I thought if I got into that program, I could meet the professor on the animation side of things and get to know him and get into the program. And then that's really when it all kind of came back full circle. I realized that was late 90s. There were people like David Carson. There were kind of designers who were breaking a little bit away from what corporate design had to be, creating a career out of that kind of cut and paste, experimental DIY aesthetic and applying it to big brands and big companies. So that's definitely a through line. I will say there was that. So as soon as I graduated, I moved to Boston. All I cared about at that point was being, I don't know why in my mind, I wanted to be a super well-known designer. There were these,
like,
Paula Scher had just created like everything she was creating at the time was just recognizable as hers, but also just like perfectly suited for whatever theater or whatever brand she was working with. Stefan Sagmeister had just come to New York and was doing this super kind of thoughtful conceptual work. But I think the problem I found was I just found myself being like an extreme pleaser. Like I entered every project through the eyes of the client or through the eyes of our creative director or the agency I was working for. And it was great for like making your way in that profession. I think it was amazing at 28, 29 to be a creative director of global brand accounts.
Sure.
But I was just not really, I'd lost the thread of that kind of, you know, that, I just had not kind of established a voice of my own. I'd maybe lost that DIY thread.
Yeah. So tell me about sort of realizing that and kind of finding what'd you do? How'd you find your voice?
So we were in New York for about 7 or 8 years, and I just kept getting bigger and bigger clients. So I got these global clients. I started to move towards that riding the line between the visual and the strategic side of brand development, campaign rollout, product rollout. Mm-hmm. And 3 years in a row, three CEOs I worked with went to jail for corporate fraud, embezzlement.
Oh, wow.
It's just like this was not me. Like, again, it was, you're winning awards, you're getting big projects, you're getting hired by great firms, but it just was not for me. We had two kids at the time. We'd bought an apartment in the Kensington neighborhood in Brooklyn, which at the time was nothing. Mm-hmm. And slowly, like, you look out your window and someone's like doing yoga in the park, or like a Thai restaurant would open up.
From heroin to yoga.
Yeah. It was it was like a 2 or 3 year change. Sure. Our apartment was worth, you know, a decent amount of money. We just sold it. We got in the car and just started driving. We ended up in Dallas, which seemed like a weird place to land. Mm-hmm. I had a friend that I'd worked with quite a bit named Frederick Broden. He's a Swedish photographer, a conceptual photographer. And we rented a 8,000 square foot studio together and just decided I'm going to put the last 6 or 7 years of corporate brand development aside. Maybe keep the kind of thinking and the process and the strategic side of what went into those projects, but apply it to companies that I care about or brands that I care about. And that was really, I mean, I was working with a bunch of pro skaters, a bunch of pro BMXers, and then with like Scion and Southwest Airlines and Stetson and brands where like, I don't know, I just felt more aligned with the product, with the customer, with the brand.
Yeah.
And you know, that kind of space. And you realize again, if you're, there was no boss, there was no creative director, there was no studio or agency owner above you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sitting in a giant empty room, there's a lot of space to try things, you know, and there are definitely some swings and misses, but definitely did the best work I've ever done kind of in that spot.
So some big lessons there.
Yeah.
Sounds like, you know, some sounds like stuff that takes some people a lifetime to figure out or some never do. You know, thinking about today, what are the things you learned, you know, during that time that are, you know, really relevant to the business you're building now?
Yeah. I mean, there's some stage pilot definitely takes some of the kind of ethos from things we learned back then. We built kind of an ethos around this brand, things we learned back then. Mm-hmm. The biggest one in my mind is just we've got to have a culture where everybody expects excellence from themselves. Like everybody believes if this isn't your dream job, if you're not perfectly suited for the role you're in, mm-hmm. if you don't feel like you can just do the best work you're ever possibly going to do in your life or your career, then this just isn't the spot for you.
Yeah.
So that just taking the time and finding people to kind of work with, finding voices to bring to the table that everybody's just inspired and kind of excited to work with.
So get that. That's brilliant. Hard to do. So you know, be the HR guy for a minute and like, you know, how do you, cause you know, look, I've hired, you know, a million people or whatever feels like, and you know, they'll all sit there and tell you that this is their dream job and they're perfect for it. And they're going to, you know, outperform anyone you've ever seen and blah, blah, blah. And you know, I've come to learn, they all believe it in the moment. Yep. And I think part of the job of leadership is to prevent people from making bad decisions decisions that are bad for both themselves and your business. Right.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? How do you find those people? How do you check, you know, whether or not they're, you know, whether or not this is really their dream job and they're going to be excellent in the role that you're about to put them in?
Well, we've been lucky in that we were a 4-person company for 7 years and then just completely exploded this past year. And we're about 20 now. So we've been doing quite a bit of hiring for the past year. Mm-hmm. I will say there are a lot more amazing interviewers than there are amazing teammates. You know, like I say, a lot of people know how to kind of sound good. It took a minute to figure out how to get through that and not just think like, man, this guy's amazing. This girl's amazing. Let's just, mm-hmm. let's jump right in. Mm-hmm. But for 7 years, we were just a technology company that supplied technology to the entertainment industry.
Okay.
So we worked with every label, a lot of great management companies, VIP companies. And over that 7 years, it like core to, I think everybody here is super serving, over serving fans, artists, management teams. So we had really strong relationships with 3 or 4 people at every client. Mm-hmm. And it just happened that as the pandemic hit and a lot of companies were furloughing or laying off employees, we were growing like by the week. And we just reached out to the best client or two, best person at every one of our client or two, and mm-hmm. just said, mm-hmm. you know, we've worked together in this way and in that way. And why don't you come on board? And like half of those people said yes. And we just built the core, the leadership team, just from the dream team of people we've worked with in the past few years. And obviously that's not always, that can't always happen, right? You don't always have a pandemic or some kind of, you know, global situation that lets a lot of super talented people be available.
But that, look, I mean, that's a great approach to hiring. And I've learned to kind of do that as much as possible, which is, you know, I always say the best way to learn whether you want to work with someone is to work with them.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, almost all of my great people, I've just hired them for an individual project.
Yeah.
Right. You know, once, and then we go, oh, this is awesome. Let's keep doing it. Right. And then you, and like you said, you can't always do that, but I think, you know, it's such a great thing to realize that a great interviewer is not the same as a great employee or team member or whatever. And, you know, and people do, you know, both sides are the worst for all the imperfections in that process.
Also, great employee or team member at 4 or 5 person company is different than a 20 person company is different than 100 or 1,000 person company. So
yeah,
we have a big kind of fail fast thing. I don't care if you fail. In fact, if we're not failing, obviously we're not trying hard enough. Yep. We're going to have some misses, but I want to do it in a day or a week. I don't want to fail over the course of a month or two. And it's the same with team members. When people come on board, we're clear up front. If this isn't a fit, no hard feelings, no harm done. Go do something else. And I think that's something we've had a few folks that have come on and just, we love them in one way or another, but just wasn't a great fit, and part ways, stay connected and maybe work together in another fashion down the road.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll tell you, you know, I think, you know, I've worked with a lot of art directors, you know, the great ones are, you know, they expect to fail in the sense that you deliver a concept and there's no illusion that this is meant to be perfect, right? It's meant to be a work in progress. And, you know, they realize, and I think that's part of what you learn in, you know, as a designer, right, is that the feedback and the, you know, iteration and editing refinement process is crucial to producing great work. And I think that's hard for a lot of people that don't have that background, right? Is they, you know, people turn in a piece of work or they show up, you know, in the morning and they expect to just be told how, you know, what a great job they're doing, right? And that's not, you know, I don't think that's a character flaw. I think that's training. I think, you know, you have to have it kind of beaten into you one way or another that, you know, it's never right at the beginning. Nothing is ever right the first time. And it's not supposed to be, right?
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? It's not going to be. Yeah. And that was a hard lesson, right? I mean, I clearly remember my first big design firm I worked for in Boston. I worked for a guy named Bob Kellerman that whether he knew it or not, I mean, one, he meant a lot to me before I worked there. He's super smart designer, but man, he had 100 resumes from art school graduates on his desk at all time. And I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it was like, if you walk into a situation and you get your feelings hurt, you know, on minute one, because 100% of your idea wasn't taken.
There
are other people who will kind of grow in that way and will learn to kind of evolve ideas. And I think what became apparent was the people that get really good at that, the people, and this is maybe bigger in the design world than anywhere else, the people that are able to kind of understand a need and then craft some solutions and kind of partner with other people or listen to other people, they're just big question askers. I think people who walk in and are like, it's going to be A, it's going to be B, it's going to be C, and then we're going to do D, and then we're done. That always makes me nervous. And that kind of comes back in our hiring process. People that are so like just insanely sure of themselves on minute one make me nervous. I think the person that comes in, asks a ton of questions, does not feel compelled to have an answer on the spot, does not tell it like it is from minute one. I don't see that as a flaw. I don't see that as they're not kind of an expert in their space. I see that as someone that's got like curious, just wants to get as much information as humanly possible, learn every possible thing you can, then start to drill down on the solution.
So now you're leading a team, right? You know, what you just said, how much can you teach that? Or do you just have to find the people that are that way already?
This could be a flaw with me. I think you have to find, it's gotta be at least 50% there when you start. No,
I think you're right. I think you're right.
I don't know that you take someone that is immediately confident in everything they do, especially if they're young and don't have experience and haven't built those thoughts. Whether they've seen it somewhere, or they've heard it somewhere, whether it's a meme or a hashtag. I mean, this like assault of just sound bites, and that becomes my ethos. That becomes my kind of guiding principle. It's maddening to me. I think it's, you know, and it, I don't know, maybe I'm sure there are people who can kind of craft that and grow and nurture those people into more of a thoughtful teammate. I just don't see it. We're moving so fast. We're really interested in just building a team of people who from the get-go, at least 50% of their outlook is, I don't know the answer until we have a conversation.
I love that. So go back a little bit. Tell me about how the idea for Stage Pilot came together. And, you know, tell me about kind of getting it off the ground.
Yeah. So we moved to Nashville for kind of family reasons. We had three kids at the time and had never lived by family. My wife's family is here. So mm-hmm. we closed Meat and Bones, which was my design company in New York and Dallas, moved to Nashville and became the creative director of Emma email marketing company that's since been purchased by Campaign Monitor. And, you know, immediately went back to this idea that it was a great environment, really great group of people, but it just was not for me.
Yeah.
Stepped away and I'd had in my back, I mean, completely different from what StagePilot is now. I had in the back of my head this idea that as smartphones got better and better, as everyone started buying DSLRs and cameras, everywhere you look, people are just amassing photos and videos. Like they're mm-hmm. just curating this life story. And it's stored, you know, on memory cards and hard drives. And there was no yep. Google Photos or Apple Photos at the time. And so the thought was, I wanted to create a place where from generation to generation, you could build and share and pass on your visual story or your legacy. Mm. And core to it would be privacy, no data mining, no advertising, not kind of, mm-hmm. you know, spoiling those memories by turning them into a commodity.
Sure.
Instead, having a subscription model where you paid for that kind of privacy. I called a friend and client that I work with for years named Robert Turner from a Starbucks parking lot, not thinking he would answer the phone. And when he picked up, I kind of fumbled my way through this thought and he was amazing. He said, just come out to Steamboat where he was hanging out for the summer and let's talk through it. In a week's time, we had prototyped the whole thing, came up with mm-hmm. with a revenue model. He invested in the company and at the time it was called Archiver. It launched in beginning of 2013. Mm. It did remarkably well until Apple Photos, Google Photos, right. and at the time Dropbox launched a sure. similar product and then yep. was decimated overnight. Like
of course.
First huge cutoff at the knees for Archiver yeah. went to zero growth overnight. But we had,
brutal.
You know, we still had money in the bank. We took a look at who was using it, how they were using it, and noticed that, like a lot of times people say, yes, it's important to me to organize all these memories, but are they going to mm-hmm. sit down for 48 hours and gather it all, digitize right. it, upload? Probably not. But when people were getting married, like my story and your story are coming together. Mm-hmm. That seemed like a popular time for people to get into our world. And so we launched a wedding app called Ceremony that is still, you know, is kind of rolling today and does remarkably well today. And it was just, it gathered all of your guests' photos and videos and created a timeline of high resolution kind of memories
oh, cool.
through the yeah. lens of all your guests. And you'd walk away Great. From your wedding with that.
Yeah.
And then that was used by a tour manager here in Nashville who was like, man, could we do this at a concert? Could we crowdsource mm-hmm. everybody's, you know, not a hashtag, not on Instagram, but could we just get everybody's high-res assets in a place that we could go ahead and reuse them. And so we quickly propped up a non-wedding branded version of that.
Cool.
And that's how we got into the music world.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, I love that. Sounds painful, right? You know, you think you got some momentum happening and then, you know, these giant companies like, you know, something that's, yeah. meaningless to them changes your life, you know, overnight.
But yeah. it's I mean, what hurt the most was privacy was the polar opposite of where they were coming from. Right.
Sure. Of course.
There was no privacy. Every shred of I remember out at Google once getting a rundown of their facial recognition technology, thinking mm-hmm. about adding some ability to kind of sort your photos based on what's in them. And then just all walking away like wide-eyed and terrified that basically they can look at the back of your head in a photo in a crowd right. and know everything about you.
So crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was, you know, it was like the whole idea of failing. It was heartbreaking a little bit. It was kind of our baby, but I don't think any of us expected that on day one, we were going to come up with a solution for,
sure.
for yeah. the company. And, you know, we were flexible and pivoted and moved and shifted perfectly fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I think that's part of the process. Right. And I think it's just, you know, it may be fun or not fun, right. Depending on, the situation, right? But you know, kind of what you're talking about is just like, okay, you know, this happened. Now, what do we do next, right? And we got this feedback.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, let's go now. Like, let's start over. Let's take from where we're at and go over there, right? And and so, you know, along those lines, right? As you said, you know, everything changed again last year with the pandemic. You know, I have a few friends in the live streaming business, and you know, from my uninformed perspective, it seemed to go from about, you know, 5 players in the space to like 50 or 100.
Yeah.
Pretty much overnight, right? Yeah. Or over 60 days or something like that. So tell me about kind of going through that and you know, how you then decided to adapt to that changing landscape and you know, where do you take it from there?
So as the pandemic started, Archiver had been shifted to be called Archiver VIP, and all of our technology was built around the VIP ticket holder in a venue, mm-hmm. getting them in the door seamlessly, being sure they get the right merch package, giving them things to do, whether it's like flash sales or whatever. If they have a photo taken, getting that photo to their phone immediately. And about 250 tours at any time, like, and it was every day, it was like Metallica tonight and Peppa Pig tomorrow. It was a pretty good range of people using it. When the pandemic hit, obviously that was completely gone. There was just, again, went down to zero overnight. And we had a good team. You know, we had, again, still had money in the bank, and just that everybody, there was such a land grab for live streaming. Mm-hmm. We decided to start with what would a VIP experience look like with no venue. So we took a month or two and built the kind of core of Stage Pilot, which is this virtual meet and greet platform where fans can log into kind of a virtual waiting room and chat with each other, shop for merch, watch videos, whatever the artist wants. And then one by one, enter into a video call like this with the artist. Mm-hmm. And we knew it would go well. There are a lot of VIP tickets that had been put on hold and needed to have some kind of experience. It was bananas. I mean, it just went from like, you know, you get a meet and greet photo taken backstage. You kind of go through a line, you have a quick arm around somebody, smile and move on. This was like 2 minutes in my living room with, you know, an artist in their living room. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of spark of this is bigger than just a kind of holdover for the pandemic was pretty immediate. And then artists started doing, you know, not 30 fans, but 100 fans, and then 500 fans, and then 1500 fans, and just making this part of their week and month.
Yeah.
And the feedback was, this is great. But like you say, there are all of these live streaming startups. And so if there's a complete event, you're buying a ticket over here, and then you're jumping into a live stream over there, and a meet and greet over here, and merch over there. And it was a pretty disjointed experience. And I think mm-hmm. artists were incredibly mm-hmm. sensitive to having a very seamless, I'm already doing this virtually. We're already doing it with technology. And so we again, kind of stepped back and built kind of the first ticketing, live streaming, meet and greet, merchandise platform, and kind of went back on an early thought, and it was incredibly informed by data. So mm-hmm. we just learned, where are people buying? When are they buying? What are they buying? And so much of our work is partnering with artists and doing series mm-hmm. of events. How can we be sure each one is just more informed, more dialed into what fans want, and just get better and better? There's a little fear, I think, that so many live stream companies were loaded up with VC capital and were really just bleeding money, paying artists hundreds of thousands of dollars to be on their platform.
Totally.
Our thought was, we're not paying anybody. Every mm-hmm. event we've ever done has been profitable. Mm-hmm. And if we lost some, that would be okay. If we get some, that's okay. But, you know, we'd been around for 8 years. We were going to stay around for, you know, for the future. So mm-hmm. that was a little bit of a hurdle at first. The artists were like, great, how many, you know, what are you going to put into the pot to get this going?
Right.
But we found this niche with, I don't know about you, at 2 months into the pandemic, I had seen 1,000 live streams. Mm-hmm. Some were just amazing, but most were like, this is my arena show that happens to be filmed.
Yep.
That's available on YouTube. It's available in a venue. It's available. So we started going to artists and saying, like, what can you not do on stage? Like, what is mm-hmm. the thing you've always wanted to do? Mm-hmm. You know, some of them are super into cooking or into sneakers or into car. Like, let's build an event And you're not going to get 100,000 fans. You might get 10,000 fans. You're not going to get a million fans. Yeah. You might get 50,000 fans. Mm-hmm. But let's dial into something just completely unique to you. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, we've done everything from a cooking show with Lauren Elena, where instead of a typical release party, she was quarantined in Airbnb and we sent out some gear and she sent out a recipe and all the fans kind of made a pizza together while she sang new songs. Like,
nice.
Those are the types of things that I'm much more interested in than just, let's just snap back to what you did pre-pandemic. Let's just film your arena show and let's try to get as many people as humanly possible to buy a ticket.
No, I think that's brilliant. I mean, that was definitely the question that I was asking, of clients and folks I was working with right at the time is like, you know, there is no substitute for being live in the room, and being shoulder to shoulder with other people who are losing their minds at the same, right? In this, you know, sharing those moments and the drinks and the socialization and the hookups and all that stuff, right? So like, stop trying to just be a worse version of that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Think,
you know, you're 100% right to think, okay, you know, what are all the things you can't do in that environment that maybe we can explore?
Yeah.
And I think that's where the great stuff's going to come out of. And I think, you know, I'm interested to see where it goes now, right? Like, you know, as we were talking about before, you know, all of a sudden tours are back. They're selling out. People clearly want to be out of the house and want to be having these experiences that we missed out on for a year and a half. You know, I have to guess that the live streaming folks, like it's got to be tough right now for them. And I was even hearing that from, 6 months ago that like artists were kind of like, I don't want to do it. It's not enough money for me to really do something that I don't love.
Yeah.
And I'll just wait. Right. And so I'm sure that's only gotten worse.
Yeah.
So what does it look like now? If things are reopening and if you look out at the next year ahead.
Yeah.
How does it change for you?
We've hired quite a few folks from the VIP companies we used to work with. So we're now ticketing and executing live in-person VIP.
Cool.
And that's great.
Yeah.
The other side, we're still doing quite a bit of virtual work, but I think our interest and focus right now is if you're putting on a 50-date tour through the US or you're doing a 78-date tour through US and UK or through Europe, what do all the other fans get who are just never going to be in a city you come through?
Totally.
So we're building this hybrid model where we'll be on tour, but what are all the things we can do for fans who aren't there? So we'll do virtual meet and greets. We are doing virtual meet and greets in the off days. But what about like, we've got an artist that loves cooking chicken wings, like barbecue chicken wings. So we have like a live stream cookout once a month. We're doing some things with folks who are live streaming from their tour bus. We're live streaming from backstage. And that's just all built around the touring cycle.
Right.
So there is the ability to use, people's kind of openness to experience entertainment at home now, use technology to kind of extend your reach beyond the folks that are in the cities you tour through. Mm-hmm. But if you put touring aside and think about that cycle of, I write a single, an album, I drop merch, like what are all the things I do off tour?
Right.
We're able to kind of keep artists engaged with fans. And again, off cycle, it might be just your core fans, your super fans, your VIP fans. But what are all the things we can do to keep them engaged, whether it's streaming from the studio while you're tracking, whether it's streaming a release party, whether it's, and so I think there's going to be space for everything. And Stage Pilot's kind of position is if we are giving the same level of service to in-person tours, to virtual events, to hybrid events, if we're partnering with folks, and again, really understanding what is it that, I don't think a lot of people ask artists, What would you want to do if you weren't on a stage? Like, get to know them, get to understand them, get to understand their fans. We're just continually crafting experiences that just would not be doable backstage or on stage. And I think as long as you create interesting, unique, intimate, honest experiences, there's always going to be a fan for that.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think, I think it's an interesting juxtaposition, right? You were talking about taking chances, fail fast, right? This, you know, this design creative process, right? And at the same time, you know, you have big stars, you know, you have Lil Yachty, you have, you know, Kehlani, right? People who have, they have brands to protect.
Yeah.
And celebrities are under more scrutiny in some ways, you know, than they've ever been. So it's like that.
Definitely.
You know, that's always a moving target, right? So, so I think, you know, getting them to take chances, right, or to think differently about how they engage with fans is a really, it's an interesting challenge.
Yeah, I think the way you do that is the same way. There's this, I can't even remember the guy's name. Years ago at a wedding, I met a guy who he made props for The Wire, the show The Wire. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was art directing a ton of kind of corporate photo shoots. So, you know, you might be in a studio and you have four very specific sets,
right,
and everything out. Yep. That is just crew and client. Mm-hmm. And he was saying every drawer you open, every piece of paper, everything is designed and thought through.
Sure.
So it was not part of the script, but if somebody leaned over and picked up a piece of paper and turned it over, it wasn't a blank piece of paper.
Right.
And that kind of like, I simplify that in my mind to like the phrase light the room, like light more than what you expect to shoot. Mm. And we take that same approach with virtual events. And I think the best possible example was, and this is really nothing we really planned for. You mentioned Yachty. He did meet and greets after a live stream. He was doing them from the studio, but everything ran late and he had to get to the airport and did not think he would have time to meet these fans. Mm-hmm. He's insanely engaged with fans. There is no chance he's going to let fans down. So we like quickly huddled, put him in the back of some like luxury car, lit it with the dome light. Mm-hmm. And he did his meet and greets rolling around town in the back of this, you know, baller car with a bunch of 15-year-olds one at a time. And it ended up being like the best possible event, you know.
Yeah.
Production budget was zero.
Yeah.
Planning was zero. Just the ability to think on your feet, understand what's available to you. And like at a moment's notice, have the right people in the room to come up with an idea, sell it through, have that rapport with an artist, and just jump in a car and run the event from the backseat of a car.
That's brilliant. So what do you learn from the artists that you're working with?
Yeah. One is, I think I have a much deeper appreciation for the complexity of an artist's life. You know, they're mm-hmm. managed up and down, wall to wall.
Sure.
I think a lot of what we do is downtime. You know, if you're doing 40 meet and greets, we're on a call an hour before that. We're on a call for a few minutes between.
Yeah.
Like everybody else, you just want to be heard, be respected. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of rapport building. We've built relationships with artists that I don't typically go into a situation thinking I want to become friends with the artist. And that's important to the rest of the crew here. This isn't your time to kind of become friends with someone and snap a photo for Instagram. But we've spent so much time just listening to people talk and just having an open ear and understanding, like between calls, you know, like that. Another thing with Yachty, he's a big sneaker fan, like understanding these little things that kind of make you interesting and make you, if you mm-hmm. listen enough and then come back and present back to them, you know, I heard you say this, what if we tried that? I saw you reacted this way to this. What if we tried that? I think that mm-hmm. ability to be a sponge, understand kind of what makes them unique, not their Instagram persona, not their TikTok mm-hmm. persona, mm-hmm. not their stage persona, but as a person, what kind of drives them. That really fosters a partnership that we can start doing things other than, again, replicating your public persona in a virtual way or in a backstage or in a VIP setting.
That's great. And you know, part of why I wanted to talk to you, you know, there's an article this morning about, you know, Spotify announced they're trying to, they had this thing of enabling 1 million artists to live off their music, right? And, you know, I was talking about the difference between a musician and a content creator. Yeah. And I think, you know, the reality is they have to be both, right? To be successful in the environment today, you have to be both. And, you know, the volume of content and experiences and engagements that content creators are forced to put out is just, you know, it's staggering and it's only getting worse.
Yeah, and the scrutiny you put on every single piece of content, right? The scrutiny on every interaction, the scrutiny on everything you put out in the world, it's intense.
Well, I was talking to my son this morning. I was like, you know, if you're a movie director, you have to have a great idea every 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and that's right.
And if you're Mr. Beast, you have to have an idea that your fans want, you know, 4 times a week or more, right? Like it's just, it's nonstop. And, you know, and so I think, you know, the kind of stuff you're doing is really important because it get, you know, cause most artists are not going to sit there, you know, in the room with the manager and just come up with all these brilliant things that they can execute on their own. Right. And so they need the right partners and they need the kind of thinking that, that I think you guys are bringing to the table to be able to turn some of those everyday moments or those, you know, like I said, that downtime in, into something.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Nice. I love it. Well, let me get to a quick lightning round before I let you go.
You got it.
What's your favorite city to travel to?
Back to New York still.
Nice.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite DJ?
I'm not super into DJs, but Alta is by far my favorite, a little lower than the Angels. They came up as one of our software engineers put one of their videos in our demo environment. So when we test new live stream features, that's there. And so I am pretty deep into Alta right now.
Nice. That's awesome. What's the last great book you've read or listened to?
Yeah, I think I've been on a real tear of nonfiction lately, but when I go back to just storytelling and just kind of creating a picture of somebody's life, my oldest son's name Holden. And I think back to Catcher in the Rye was a book I read right when we got married and was so influential to just me as trying to become a more evolved storyteller. I think it's still hard to beat, you know, that Holden Caulfield kind of character and persona. So
it's a great book. And it's one that, you know, I think for most of us, you're forced to read it at a time when you probably have the least interest.
That's exactly right.
So that's
like, that's all great art, right? You might see it in one environment and it just doesn't click with you, but when you take the time to think about it or your life evolves or circumstances evolve, it has a different connection. And now I see my 3 boys reading it and it's just, it's a, that one's been, it's had a good kind of cycle with me.
Sure. That's great. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
That's a good question. I think recently, probably Royal Tenenbaums last 10 years because I was a big fan of Wes Anderson when it came out. I had a friend that did some of the titling work. So I watched a lot with them. And then as my kids got older, they got into Wes Anderson and they started watching their films. I think we've probably watched Tenenbaums 1,000 times in the past 10 years in our house.
I mean, it's worth it. What a great movie.
Could be worse, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Who's someone you've learned a lot from that you haven't met?
That's an interesting question. I think, man, if I go back into the kind of design world, I mean, he's a name that at one point everybody talked about and I did some work with him in the kind of early 2000s and he's kind of completely fallen off the map. His name was Bill Cahan. Mm-hmm. He started an agency called Cahan Associates in the early 2000s in San Francisco. And he, I think single-handedly that firm and a handful of the art directors and designers there took corporate design into the conceptual space, not in the jokey space, not in the goofy, let's make the kind of goofiest, stupidest commercial and hope people remember how dumb it was, but like the most kind of intelligent. Yeah. Look up Cahan and Associates. Look at some of the reports they created. It put me on a different career track. And then working with Bill a couple of times kind of put me on a bit of a different personal track. It was
nice.
He's a big influence. Yeah. Never met him in person.
So if I worked at Stage Pilot, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
Oh man, I think there are a couple things. I think we talk a lot about you watch The West Wing?
A little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think chief of staff has this phrase, like, keep the knucklehead stuff off the president's desk. Like, let's keep the knucklehead stuff out of our, like, get it done and get it over with. Let's not focus on the minutiae. Let's not focus on the little things that aren't important. Fail fast is a big one. I mean, I want everybody to take time and experiment every week and every month without the fear of this isn't going to produce something. And then the last one is, you know, for a risk of being brash, is give a fuck. Like, you really, if you don't care, if you're not personally invested in every fan, you know, if you're customer support, it's easy to be like, no, you can't live stream on a flip phone. But, you know, I mean, if you don't care about each fan, each artist, each client, then you're really just in the wrong spot. So that, like, deeply care about everyone we're working with. Those are probably the three biggest.
Those are great. And I was with a buddy the other day who's he runs a big record label. And so he said that, you know, his friends with kids will always send, you know, they'll always send them their kids' music. And he said, you know, my rule is, if they've listened to all of the music they're sending me and they believe in it, then I'll listen to it.
Yeah.
And he's like, 90% of the time, you know, when I tell them that, I never hear from them again.
Yeah.
Like, they maybe listen to the one song and they just forward it along. And he's like, you know, if they, and so by the time they go back and they realize, oh, this maybe isn't that good, he's like, don't make it my job to, you know.
Yeah, so, man, have a filter. That's the knucklehead stuff. Have a filter. Right. Think it through. Yeah. If that's not worth moving along, drop it and move to the next thing.
Yeah. No, I love that. That's great, man. Well, dude, I appreciate the conversation. It's awesome. Yeah. Excuse me.
Yeah, man, appreciate it. Talk to you. Bye.
Yeah, that was Chris Corby on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you check out stagepilot.com to see what they have coming up. I'm sure some of your favorite artists might be on there. Give us some feedback. Hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, wherever you like. We're at Rebel Radio Net. We have videos of a lot of our episodes showing up on our YouTube channel. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.